Issues Etc. 24, Hour 11, starts now.
Choir of King's College with the hymn, The Church is One Foundation. Well, that's certainly true, and even Lutherans sing that, but I imagine that those who hear Lutherans singing that might think we're being disingenuous. They accuse Lutherans, and Luther in particular, of splitting the church, of taking that one foundation and trying to divide it up. Maybe he intended to start a new church. Is that true? Or maybe he didn't intend to start a new church, but he did anyway. And in fact, he began not just a split, but a fractioning of the church, a schism in the church, so that now we have, as many people will contend, well, really, innumerable different sects and divisions and denominations in the church. Is that true? We're going to take up that myth of Lutheranism. Dr. Martin Nolan, during this hour of Issues Etc. 24, I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. You can join us with questions or comments on the myth about Lutheranism that Luther intended to start a new church. 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Send your questions to us via email. We get them right here in the studio in real time. Talk back at issuesetc.org. Leave your question for us, and please include your city and state at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc, or send us a tweet at issuesetc. Dr. Martin Nolan is a regular guest, and he's former director of the Concordia Historical Institute. He's pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana. Marty, welcome back.
Good to be here, Todd.
How do we respond to this, that whether he intended to or not, Luther split the church, and it's just been splitting more and more, shattering even, ever since?
The first thing we need to say to that is that the church was already divided organizationally at the time of Luther, and that had been the cause of the result of some reforms, which we'll talk about this evening, in about the middle of the 11th century, when the Pope sent a cardinal to Constantinople and put a edict of excommunication on the altar where the archbishop or patriarch of Constantinople would pray. And this was a edict of excommunication against the entire church, basically. And this was the beginning of what's known as the Great Schism, and the East and the West have never really seen eye to eye since. And this was really the fault of the Pope, because he was claiming the sort of authority which Jesus never gave him, nor did any other previous council or anything else. So the whole notion of being a schism in the church, and that was all Luther's fault, is just wrong. There were also other Christian churches in the East that had never accepted the teachings of the Council of Chalcedon. These were in Syria. In fact, some of the churches that are now being destroyed in Syria and Iraq, they date back to those days. They were never part of the Roman Empire. They were never part of the Roman Imperial Church. So this is a little bit specious to say that Luther, that he destroyed the unity of the church. It never was entirely unified. But to say it is true that the things that he started resulted in the division of the western portion of the church, that is a accurate statement. The question is, did he really intend for that to be the result?
So how are we going to approach this here? Because we certainly do have a large number. And we're talking about, if we look at the swath of the world here today, depending on how you want to cut the pie, tens of thousands of various different Christian denominations, sects, church bodies, whatever you confessions, what you want to call them. It's not Luther's intent to start a new church, you contend, but you say it has something to do with the law of unintended consequences. What do you mean?
Well, yeah, this is, well, first off, let's make a distinction between reform and schism. Reform means that you change the church while staying within it. You have no intention of leaving it or dividing it. You intend to change the practice and perhaps the doctrine of the church. You know, this goes on regularly in every church body. It can get kind of heated sometimes, even in congregations. But, you know, things need to be fixed. That's the notion of reform. And then the idea of schism is that you change the church by leaving it, which, of course, you have changed the church because you've taken a good chunk out of it, and you set up a separate church, a counter church, or an anti-church. So these two notions of reform and schism are two entirely different ideas. And it's clear that Luther's intent was reform, and he had a long precedent. We'll talk about that this evening in this hour. A long precedent of the notion of reform in the church. But now, this reform idea did not work out the way that he planned. And this is, as you mentioned, the law of unintended consequences. Now, this idea, that term, dates back to the time of John Locke, who was discussing economics, discussed the unintended consequences of interest rate regulation. We know about that in inflation and monetary policy today. This was also discussed by Adam Smith, who was one of the leading thinkers of economics and the Scottish Enlightenment. Now, there is a relatively recent, 1936, a sociologist published a paper that has been very influential. And the title is very related, I think, to this notion of reformation. The title of the paper was The Unanticipated Consequences of Purposive Social Action. Now, what Luther was doing was exactly, he clearly thought out what needed to be done to the church, and this was a social entity. And action was, so this is exactly what was going on. Now, Merton, who is the author, lists five possible causes of unanticipated consequences, and I'm going to take each one of those causes and put it into Luther's situation. The first cause of unanticipated consequence is ignorance. That is impossible often to anticipate everything, thereby leading to incomplete analysis. And now Luther, as we know, was not omniscient. He never claimed to be. He did not claim to have the Holy Spirit in a special measure. And he admitted that in his original thinking, in approach to reform, he was inept. This is found in his 1545 preface to his Latin writings. And he admits that he made some mistakes, politically and otherwise, not doctrinally. Second, Merton notes that errors in analysis of the problem or following habits that worked in the past may not apply to the current situation. Now, this applies directly to the reform process that Luther used. He used processes that had worked for monasteries, mendicant orders, and the 11th century reforms. But guess what? It didn't work for the whole church in the 16th century. And then the third point or cause of unintended consequences is that immediate interests override long-term interests. This is probably maybe obvious, but it needs to be said that the financial and power interests of the Vatican overrode theological, moral, and spiritual interests. And finally, point four that Merton makes is that basic values may require or prohibit certain actions, even if the long-term result might be unfavorable. Now, here are the basic medieval values that were challenged. Now, maybe Luther didn't realize he was challenging these, but they were. And these basic medieval values were, first, the organizational unity of the church. Second, the authority of the church over the state. That is the whole notion of medieval. The authority of emperor over princes, a monarchical governing model, and finally the church's role in the empire as a moral guardian and unifying social force. And the reform of Luther, once the papacy and the thinkers in the Catholic Church thought about it, they said, these basic values are going to change everything. And they were right. So this is why I think we can use this principle of unintended consequences to say that Luther intended to reform the church, but the nature of what he was doing ended up actually splitting the church, and that was not his intent.
It's not as though Luther's attempt, whatever he intended, was not the first. In fact, really, I mean, you can tell the story in a lot of ways of the church in a broad sweeping way by talking about the various moves for reform. Take us back to, can we even go back to the church fathers prior to, say, medieval reform attempts?
Yeah, there's an important book published in 1959 by G.B. Ladner, and it's called The Idea of Reform. And this book, it's a classic, looks at the notion of reform in the era of the early church. Now, we hardly ever talk about that. I had some excellent courses in patristics and early church, both at Fort Wayne and at Union Theological Seminary, by some of the leading scholars. And I don't remember them really talking about the notion of reform, and maybe that term wasn't used, but there was the idea of individual renewal in the image of God that was found particularly in monasticism. So the transformation of the individual person and the reform of their life and their being was something that was very prominent in the early church. And so then that prepared the ground for the idea of reform, not just of the individual, but also of society. Now, I want to go into the first person, I think, is very significant for developing this idea of reform, and that is this gentleman named Saint Benedict of Aniana. He was born about 747 and died in 821. Now, this is the time of Charlemagne. You know, Charlemagne was crowned in 800 A.D. It goes way back. And Saint Benedict of Aniana was a Benedictine monk and a reformer, and he put a huge imprint on the religious practice of the Carolingian Empire. Now, how I found out about him was my wife and I had taken a trip to Europe, and we were in Aachen, which was the capital of Charlemagne, and we were going through the museum, which is next to the cathedral, and we were looking at the section in that museum that dealt with the church, and it talked about the monasteries that were in the Carolingian Empire, and they mentioned this guy as being a reformer. Now, I was reading this all in German, and I'm thinking, what? A medieval reformer in 800 A.D.? But sure enough, that's what it was. And they had on the map that just south of Aachen was the abbey where he finished his work and where he eventually passed. That was at Corneliemünster. He tried a couple of times. The first time, he tried founding a monastery on the Eastern ascetic model in the south of France, and it didn't work. Then he tried in 782 to find another monastery based on the Benedictine rule, and this worked. And so he became a very influential administrator of monasteries, and Charlemagne took him up and said, okay, I want you to reform all these monasteries and monks and whatever that's like that here in my empire. Let's get some consistency. Let's bring up the moral level and the devotional level. And that's what he did. And very interesting, he also, toward the end of his life, compiled a book called The Concordia Regularum. That means the rules for unity. That word Concordia shows up in the title of the Book of Concord. I wonder if that had some influence on the title. But in any event, he had some impact in his lifetime. And so this notion of the reform in monastic circles, in the monastic society, was there already at the time of Charlemagne. And then in subsequent centuries, this would keep popping up almost every other century. There was either a reform or a new order with the whole idea of let's reform monasticism and thereby the interior portion of the church.
So that is, let's see, 8th century, you said. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, 9th century, basically, yeah. 800, 9th century.
That almost gets kind of a ball rolling. You talk next about the so-called Cluniac reforms. What are they?
Well, now, I've talked about this, many years ago when we first, you and I used to talk on the radio issues, et cetera, back whenever you had the office, the studio over by the St. Louis Seminary there. And I don't remember how we got into this, but I discovered that where the Western Church started going down the wrong road theologically and in practice was during what they called the Cluniac Reforms. This was a movement that was founded at Cluny in Burgundy. You know, you think of Burgundy wine. That part of France is where this is located, in 910. So it's about 100 years after this Saint Benedict. And it starts within the Benedictine order. The reforms were carried out by a guy named Saint Odo and spread throughout France and England and much of Italy and Spain. And the impetus for the reform were two significant problems, and we would agree these were problems. First was simony, that is, paying for the church. In other words, if you want to be a pastor, you'd have to pay like $1,000 as a fee to the bishop in order to do that. And that has nothing to do with your training. It's you're paying for the office. And if you don't have the money, tough for you. And so this was a way that people that had means, that were wealthy, could obtain important positions in the church. And so instead of an election, which we consider a fair method, the rich people could buy the office. That was called simony. And the other was concubinage, that is, priests and monks who were theoretically celibate actually had mistresses on the side. And this was getting to be well known and a big problem. So the Cluniac reform originally had this as the goal, to clean up simony and concubinage. But they found out that they kept getting resistance. And so one of the things that they did was to put the governorship of the monastery at Cluny under the Pope. And thereby, the local bishop could not interfere. And the Pope, well, he wanted to reform these things. And so what happened was you ended up having a more independent abbot that would better enforce the rule of St. Benedict. Then eventually all the daughter houses came under Cluny, up to be about 1,000 monasteries at the time, about the 12th century. During its height, the Cluniac movement was one of the largest religious forces in Europe. Before the construction of St. Peter's in Rome by Michelangelo in about the Renaissance, the cathedral or basilica at Cluny was the largest religious facility or structure in the world. And so this was a large reform of basically the entire monastic system in the West. And then this bled over, because they kept finding that they were getting resistance among the bishops and the other parts of the church that were not monastics. And so the people that were influenced by Cluny went on reform. And there were three popes that were what we call reform popes, Popes Leo X, Nicholas II, and especially Gregory VII, who ruled from 1073 to 1085. Now this is the 11th century. The Reform Papacy is what this was called, was an outgrowth of the Cluny reforms. And this is when the notion of a cardinal bishop was established. And the Council of Cardinal Bishops, which would we maybe in the Missouri Synod would be like the Council of Presidents, became the chief legislative assembly for the Roman Catholic Church. They eliminated the previous council of bishops and archbishops, and the Council of Cardinal Bishops, who had been handpicked by the Pope, so you have kind of a circular line of authority. This is the way that they said that they were going to keep the faith and the morals of the church. But what it did was it cut off the we would say from a democratic standpoint, the representation of the church. And so it became ingrown in a social and political way. And at the same time, they also they saw that the secular rulers were a big competition. And so this big controversy of what was called investiture, whether the secular princes could appoint the bishops, this was 1075 to 1122, this was finally won by the popes. And so that the popes could appoint everybody in the church and could even defrock, as it were, a king or emperor. And at this point, it was the highest point at which the pope and his circle had power in the West. But this is all a result of what they saw as reforms. So the whole notion of reform, even though we would see some of the results as not being good from a Christian standpoint or a Lutheran standpoint, this was still acceptable. It was seen as a model of the way to accomplish things in the church.
Somewhat ironic, isn't it, that it is through, you know, a genuine desire to reform, in this case, kind of on the monastic houses and the various abuses that were taking place there, led to what would eventually be one of the main obstacles to Luther's reforms. And that is a more powerful, kind of more absolutely powerful magisterium of the church.
Yeah, and so your reform is my obstacle, and vice versa. You know, your candy is my poison. But the idea here is that, and I'm really trying to emphasize this, is that the notion of reform was bread and butter for the Western Church. Now, it was not a common idea, I think, in the Eastern Church. And so you find in the Eastern Church, it has one form of liturgy that goes back, presumably, the time of St. Chrysostom. It's called Chrysostom's liturgy. You have one form of monasticism, which goes back to, what is it, Basil the Great, and that hasn't changed. So you really have you don't have much change in the Eastern Church. It's like it's been the same way since the time of Constantine. Whereas in the West, through the various monastic movements and their reforms, you have constant change under the guise of reform. And so when Luther said, I need to reform the church, he's not doing anything new in terms of the idea, but maybe the specific things he is attacking or trying to change, those were new.
So how would you describe the other reform movements that preceded that of Luther's, including... I think we need to, you know, discuss both kind of St. Francis of Assisi Franciscan reforms, and then, of course, John Wycliffe.
Right. The St. Francis, his big thing was poverty. You know, he had grown up as a rich nobleman. He went off to war, and it all just kind of settled in one day, and he just gave up on that whole idea. And so his notion of reform for the church was he looked at the clergy in particular, not so much the monks, but the clergy and the higher ups, the would be equivalent to our district presidents, you know, the guys that really serve high up and have contact with aristocrats and noblemen, and they were living high in the hog. And this was now in the 13th century. And without directly attacking them, he felt that the best thing that he could do, I'm talking about St. Francis, was to set an example for what Christ did. And that is, Christ, you know, he walked around with sandals and a staff and, you know, just basically clothes on his back. And so Francis thought, this is the Christian thing to do. What would Jesus do? I'm going to do what Jesus did. In the official rule of the order in 1223, the Franciscans were to, quote, observe the holy gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, living in obedience without anything of our own and in chastity. And also that rule set regulations for discipline, preaching, and entry into the order. Just the whole notion of establishing a new order here. See, they already had the Benedictines and a full monastic system there. Why did they need a new one? Well, they needed one, in Francis' opinion, because the Benedictines were living too high on the hog. And so he set up this order that would live the way Christ lived. And part of the idea was that it was almost a communist idea, that they treated each other as brothers and by nobody having anything more than the next. Now, France's original idea, although it worked okay on a small level, when it started getting big, it was a threat to the Pope and to the aristocratic bishops. And so a division occurred in the Franciscan order, and the Pope, of course, favored the group that wanted to say, we don't have to live in absolute poverty. We can have, you know, we can have a nice chariot here or there and a nice little house on the Riviera. And that version of France, the Franciscan order, was what was approved by the Pope in 1223. So he kind of took the sting out of the reform movement of the Franciscans. Now, the really most significant person that really brings all these various things together before Luther is John Wycliffe. And he lived in the 14th century, 1330 to 1384. He was a university teacher at Oxford in England. His followers were known as Lollards, and he was the earliest opponent of papal authority over secular power. So in other words, that Gregorian reform that put the Pope over secular authority, Wycliffe said that was wrong, we need to go back the other way. Wycliffe also expounded three doctrines that the established church recognized as major threats. First was his emphasis upon an individual's interpretation of the Bible as the best guide to a moral life, as opposed to the church's emphasis on receiving sacraments. Second, he insisted that holiness of an individual was more important than official office, so that a truly pious person was morally superior to a wicked ordained cleric, and this had Donatist overtones. And then finally, he attacked the luxurious and exorbitant luxury and pomp of the churches and their ceremonies, and that, of course, was a continuation of the critique that Francis had done. Now, Wycliffe died before anything could be done about him, but he was condemned posthumously at the Council of Constance in May 1415, which was supposedly a reform council, but the reform was that they got rid of Wycliffe's teaching. They condemned his followers, the Lollards, and they also burned at the stake two of his distant followers, John Hus and Jerome of Prague. And these guys were the immediate successors of Martin Luther in the area of reform.
Can you talk a bit about the very very order which Luther eventually joined as the son of the church, the Augustinian order? If I'm not mistaken, that was also an attempt at reform. The very order itself, wasn't it?
Right. So the Order of the Augustinian Friars was organized in 1244 by papal approval, and the idea is we're going to go back to Augustine. And, you know, Augustine's better than St. Benedict. And this was a somewhat popular order. Luther had several choices as a college student of which one he was going to join, and that was his choice. This group was split into two by the time of Martin Luther. Some of the Augustinian monasteries had become relaxed in their discipline. They were not following the rule of St. Augustine, as they said they would. So a more conservative or a stricter version developed, and they were called the Reformed Augustinians. And they began to take over the entire Augustinian order, and their biggest group was in Saxony. One of their leaders was a guy named Johannes Zachary, who was an Augustinian monk and ended up being at the professor of the University of Erfurt. So he had direct influence a generation before Luther came to Erfurt. There were several other people, but the most important successor then of the Saxon Reform Congregation was Johann von Staupitz, and he was the vicar general, that is, the general supervisor for this Reformed group. So they themselves, the Reformed Augustinians, the group that Luther joined in Erfurt, were a reforming group of Augustinian monks, and Staupitz was their leader. So this whole notion of reformation is occurring through the monastic system and the development of new orders. This is what Luther bought into when he joined the monastery.
So with that said, should we, and the reform, we should note, the reform that they were advocating was back toward a stricter form. It wasn't
correct
to loosen things. It
correct
was toward a stricter form, right?
Correct, exactly.
Does that, do you think that that in some way informs Luther later when now a reform sparked not by a desire to return to an old monastic order, but by the gospel itself, still a desire to return to something original, that notion of reform? Does that stick with Luther?
Yes, it does. And I think when he was given, you know, again, when he entered the monastery as a young man, he enters an environment where there's the whole push for reforming the Augustinian order. In fact, the reason he went to Rome was there was a dispute between the two branches within the Augustinian order, and he was asked by the Erfurt branch, the Erfurt monastery, to go represent them in Rome. And so he's struggling with this, and not necessarily always making friends, but he did make friendship with Staupitz, who realized the talents that Luther had. And when Staupitz was able to get Luther to come to Wittenberg, he gave him the responsibility for teaching the Bible in the small little school that they had there, the developing University of Wittenberg. And as Luther began to teach the Bible, he realized there were things in the Bible, in the New Testament, that weren't exactly, they didn't exactly fit exactly what Augustine was saying, because Augustine had been trained in Roman rhetoric and some of the Platonist philosophy of the day. Cicero probably was a great influence. And Luther, as he was reading the Greek New Testament, especially then, began to realize, you know, you're another couple of generations away from that with Augustine. Maybe we need to go back beyond Augustine, back to the origins, that is, St. Paul, St. John, the Apostles, and the original New Testament. And that's what he did, as he studied that in his university lectures, particularly the Book of Romans. He began to realize that it wasn't just the practice of the church that was altered, it was also the theology that had been altered. And this was the advantage of having the Greek text, and he was a great linguist. And as he was reading through this in the original Greek, things started popping in his mind and saying, man, we are really way out. We have really come a long way away from the original idea of what salvation and all these other things are all about. And so it's really a combination of things that happened to Luther. He's in this reform idea in the monasteries. He's reading the Greek Bible. He's trying to explain this all to his students. And that's how, in his own mind at first, the notion of reforming of the Christian church on the basis of the Scripture alone begins to ferment and to brew.
Dr. Martin Noland is our guest. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with him. The general theme of Issues Etc. 24 this year is myths about Lutheranism. We're dealing with the myth that Luther intended to start a new church, split the church, and a little bit later we'll take up and Dr. Noland is particularly suited toward this one, the myth that Lutherans are liberal. He has some firsthand experience with real liberalism. We'll see what he has to say about that a little bit later here on Issues Etc. 24. Feel free to join us with your questions and your comments. We're coming to you live this Friday evening, November the 14th, 1-877-623-6943. Talk back at issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet at issuesetc or leave your question or comment for Dr. Noland at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc.
Continuing education for the confessional Lutheran. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Lord of the Church, Jesus Christ, has blessed the efforts to have such a wonderful program on talk radio! Exclamation point. We praise His holy name for so abundantly showering His blessings upon it. It is my prayer that he will continue to bestow his undeserved blessings upon issues, etc. To God be the glory, !
Amen to that comment. You're listening to Issues Etc. 24. Craig Feichtinger, and I'm Jeff Schwarz. And we're asking for your support for this worldwide outreach during Issues Etc. 24. We've been on the air since we were canceled by and fired by the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and for the last 6.5 years, and you've kept us in the black all this time, and we appreciate your prayers and your financial support. And thank you for listening to Issues Etc. 24, and thanks for your past, present, and future financial support of Issues Etc.
Couple folks to thank. Thank you to Larry in Newark, Delaware, for joining the Reformation Club. Thank you, Larry. Your name is going in our hopper for a chance to win On the Church by Johann Gerhardt. And thanks to Cynthia from Macomb, Michigan, for joining the Reformation Club as well. You'll have a chance to win that book, too.
The Issues Etc. Reformation Club is a great way for you to support this worldwide outreach monthly or annually. They've got membership premiums like T-shirts, books, broadcast transcripts, and advertising for your confessional Lutheran congregation. Find out more at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Just click the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. You'll find everything you need to know about becoming a monthly or annual contributor to Issues Etc. through the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. And thanks to longtime listeners and supporters, and they're also longtime Reformation Club members, Bob and Cindy Myers in Milton, Florida. Thanks so much for your donation, and thanks for listening. And they say, thanks for another great Issues Etc. 24 broadcast, Bob and Cindy Myers, and of course, the next general manager of Lutheran Public Radio, Deontay Myers. So glad you guys are listening in Florida. I wish we had your weather right now. We're supposed to get snow here in Greater St. Louis. I think starting tomorrow, it's a little frigid outside. But hey, maybe we can, after Issues Etc. 24, maybe we can all just spend a week down in the Pensacola area with the Myers. Sounds like a plan.
I love it. We're coming to see you, Bob and Cindy.
Yeah, unannounced. Well, consider yourself forewarned. You heard it on Issues Etc. 24. So if we just show up ringing your doorbell with the sleeping bags.
I like a king size bed, no sleeping bag.
Hey, I'll take anything on the beach. So anyway, but thanks so much, Bob, Cindy, and Deontay. Good to hear from you guys, and thanks for listening down in Florida. Again, those phone numbers for you to donate to Issues Etc. 877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE, 618-223-8385 for our beloved on demand listeners. And you can also make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. Any size gift is deeply appreciated, and as a way of saying thanks, we'll send you, for any size donation, Pastor Daniel Preuss's excellent book, Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center. Call now, 877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. And in about, an hour? No, actually, we're going to draw this book in about a half hour from now. As Craig mentioned, a book that's a retail value of almost $60, On the Church by Johann Gerhardt. Anybody who makes a donation of $100 or more to Issues Etc. during Issues Etc. 24 will be in the drawing for that a half hour from now. 877-623-MYIE, 618-223-8385. Or online, issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. 24. We're dealing with myths surrounding Lutheranism. This one is really common. It's Luther intended to start a new church, that his reform actually split the church, caused schism in the church. Dr. Martin Noland is our guest, former director of the Concordia Historical Institute, pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana. Marty, you spoke briefly about this at the very beginning of our conversation, but it's time to discuss Luther's idea of reform. You talk about it as kind of an ideal. I take it that to begin with, while there are certain doctrinal reforms before Luther, Luther's was mostly on doctrine, not as much on kind of the moral life of monks or of priests or things like that.
That's correct. He had intended to, of course, reform the area of indulgences, but that was really in the sacramental system. So that is the area of ecclesiastical life in which the church is involved with laymen on a regular basis. And so it is a criticism of the priesthood, but in a systematic way. It's not talking about individual priests who maybe have moral failings. And this is maybe something that distinguished him from previous reformers. For example, Savonarola in Florence was an Italian, I believe is a Franciscan friar, and his main reform was in the area of morality, both of priests and of nobility. And so people kind of got used to the idea of a reformer in the area of morality. But to find somebody that was a reformer in the area of doctrine, this was not quite so common. And in the 1517 disputation against scholastic theology, now this is an American edition of Luther's Works, Volume 31. It's the first treatise there. 1517, before the publication of the 95 Theses, Luther in this disputation rejected the dominant scholastic idea of the time, that is, what was being taught in the universities in the area of theology and in all the schools. Dominant at that time was either the old way, which was Thomas Aquinas, or the new way, which was Willem of Ockham and the nominalist theologians, such as Gabriel Biel. And Luther rejects both of them. I mean, it's just like anybody reading this and say, okay, you rejected, you're not a Democrat, and you're not a Republican, and you're not an independent. So what are you? And so this was kind of a, it was, people were scratching their head thinking, what's he coming up with? He's going back to Augustine's theology. Now that seemed like going back to primitive times from the standpoint, because they'd all considered all the scholars in the universities considered the acquisition of the entire writing of Aristotle as a great advance. It was part of the early Renaissance. They call it the Renaissance of the 13th century. And in many ways, it did help the theology, which had been kind of more mystical, maybe more homiletical, but not very systematic. And with the help of Aristotle and his logic, they were able to really to start to use common terminology. There were really a lot of advances. And so to find Luther in 1517 rejecting all this, probably people thought, you know, what is he, some type of Luddite? So that was the first thing. He didn't really propose an alternative, but it was definitely against it. And then you have the 95 Theses in October 1517, where he rejects the theology and practice of indulgences, its related theology of penance, and, this was the big mistake, he questioned the Pope's authority in these matters, instead saying the authority in these matters goes back to Scriptures and the Apostles. In 1518, he explained the 95 Theses in a treatise by that name. In that thesis, that treatise, he set for the first time his plan for the reform of the sacrament of penance and his doctrine of faith as trust in the promises of God, so that faith justifies the sinner. And he understood this in the context of confession and absolution. So he said, if you do not believe the priest that he forgives your sins, then they are not forgiven. And therefore, the instrumental means that makes that forgiveness happen to you is your faith and belief, and not good works, and not satisfactions, or anything else. It's simply because you believe the promise that God has given to you through the mouth of the priest. This was revolutionary. It was absolutely revolutionary because it threw away everything having to do with soteriology, and that's the doctrine of salvation, in Aquinas and in the new school of William of Ockham and everybody else before. And that made people sit up and notice. They either had a world-class heretic on their hands or something new, and it was something new.
So let's from one perspective, from the now we will kind of say the Roman Catholic perspective, they noticed Luther's attempt at reform, and again, it's in the form of a scholarly treatise.
Right.
But they notice it because he is questioning the very heart of the merit system of salvation that had become, well, boilerplate in the Roman Church. From our perspective today, is Luther all the way to the gospel at this point in 1518?
I would say yes. This treatise, the explanation of the 95 Theses, and then I think it's 1519 where he delivers his paper or treatise on the two kinds of righteousness, where he states that the righteousness of God is in Christ and not in us, but we receive it by faith. Those two treatises are the essence of his theology, and he built the rest of his theology around that. It's interesting that in the criticisms that German theologians made about the turn of the last century, I mean, I'm talking about year 2000, the criticism of the joint Declaration on the Doctrine of Justification, or JDDJ, the conservative Lutheran theologians in Germany, and they're not associated with us, they said that for Lutherans, justification by faith alone is the criteria of theology. It applies to every article of faith, and Luther does that in those treatises in 1518, and therefore his Reformation breakthrough in way of thinking about theology happens at that time. And people notice that. They say this really is revolutionary. It's not just, it's not an attack on morals. It's not just changing church polity or your liturgy. It's getting at the heart of the faith, and everything's going to change if we let this stand.
So what form does that attention take in the case of Luther's proposed reforms with regard to how they regarded the sacrament of confession and absolution? How did the Roman Catholic Church then take notice?
Well, the first thing that happened was the Leipzig debate, and this was at the University of Leipzig. Johannes Eck demonstrated that Luther was opposed to the Pope, and that made him public enemy number one, and he was propounding doctrines of Jan Hus, that is, he was a Hussite, and therefore, since Hus and Wycliffe and Jerome of Prague had been condemned to burn to the stake, the intent of Eck was to say, this is what should happen to this man, too. And so Luther begins to go through the trial system in the Roman Church. He has an edict brought against him, and in response, Luther burns the canon law. And as he burns the canon law, he says, the entire purpose of the canon law is to establish the authority of the Pope over Jesus Christ. And he's absolutely right. So that's why he burns the canon law. And then he continues to write as he's going through his trial. 1520 sees his most important treatises. Anybody who reads anything in Luther will read his 1520 thesis. That includes the freedom of the Christian and the Babylonian captivity of the church. And that Babylonian captivity treatise, he overhauls, or at least gives a plan for overhauling the entire sacramental system, all seven sacraments, and why they need to be reformed. And then finally, in 1520, he writes the treatise to the Christian nobility of the German nation. And this is an appeal to the Emperor Charles V, to the electors, the princes, and the cities to reform the church because the Vatican refused. And let me read that section under the heading. It says, the three walls, quote, the Romanists have very cleverly surrounded themselves with three walls, which have protected them till now in such a way that no one could reform them. And then he goes on in the rest of that section to explain how these three walls, why they were created, and how they should be breached. So he realized from a political, social standpoint why the church had ended up in the situation that it had, and that the only way to reform it was now not going to be appealing to the Pope or the archbishops, but it would be something that the layman in the secular office of emperor, prince, elector, city councilman, these are the men that were going to have to reform the Christian church because they were the ones that were actually responsible for it. And that is also part of his doctrine of the priesthood of all believers.
So, in essence, he, in that way, essentially gives up on the possibility of channeling reform through the magisterium of the church.
Right. And also in that treatise, I think if you look at, you say, how did it end up being a unified program of reform to being a diverse one that ends up with separate state churches? It's when he probably doesn't realize it, another unintended consequence. It's when he goes to the emperor and the electors and the princes, and they are in a political feudal situation. The whole notion of a feudal system, you have to look that up, and it's very complicated. But basically, the emperor keeps the peace, and he tries to balance things off, and they work together when they have to oppose the Turk. But other times, they're fighting against themselves, and each territory has its own set of laws within the Holy Roman Empire. So when Luther goes to them and says, you are the guys that have got to do it, if they're successful, they're going to take it away from the unity of the Pope and then end up in a system where each one of those little lords and lieges are going to be able to set up their own church. And that's basically what happened.
So that's Luther's plan. He lays out the plan for reform. Does he have to change plans at some point?
Yeah, I think that he had hoped that the secular powers would be able to reform this by discussion, diplomatic means. It's like the NATO discussions or all these things that our countries of the world get together now in the United Nations, that type of thing, and that eventually reform would happen at that level. But something new happened. In 1523, there were the first martyrs of the Reformation. They were actually brothers of Luther in the Augustinian Reformed system. The two men were named Heinrich Voss and Johann Esch. They refused to reject Luther's doctrines, and they were burned at the stake in the marketplace at Brussels. Everybody has seen pictures of downtown Brussels in the marketplace of the beautiful gilded guild halls. That's where they were martyred. Another pro-Luther Augustinian friar from Antwerp, Heinrich Zitphen, also was, he escaped initially, but eventually some peasants caught up with him and killed him because any follower of Luther, according to the Edict of Worms, could be caught and put to death. And when Luther heard about this, he realized that the Roman Church was going to stop at nothing. They were going to execute everybody if they could, if they could get away with it. And at that point, he realized that this was going to lead to warfare, civil war, any number of things. It was not going to be a simple, peaceful, diplomatic solution. And then really, once it entered into that realm, it was out of his hands, because reform at that point was a matter of military protection and defense. The Convention of Regensburg in 1524 and the League of Dessau in 1525 made clear the intent of pro-papal princes that they were going to stamp out the Lutheran doctrines by force and violence. The Protestant princes responded with the Defensive League of Torgau. It's the first Protestant alliance militarily, but it's defensive only, in 1526, to protect Lutheran doctrines, their pastors, and their lay adherents. And then at the Second Diet of Speyer in 1529, the protesting princes protested against the Edict of Worms publicly and thus divided the empire between those that accepted the edict, and they were therefore pro-papal, and those that protested it, therefore, were for thereafter called Protestants.
So this is, you talked earlier about the law of unintended consequences. This is where this is, for good or for ill, spun out of any one person's control now. Luther may still be the focus of these various things, and he may be, in fact, the author, you know, of all the various essays and treatises that brought it about. but he's no longer controlling the course of the ship, is he?
That's correct. And, you know, once they're martyrs at the stake and people being killed and hunted down, then the princes have to take over because it's their job to keep the peace, to defend their people, and to prevent this sort of stuff. So, it then has a life of its own, and then it all depends on imperial politics. Now, part of this politics was, actually, the princes and the emperor really didn't want to go to war over religion. They had enough things to worry about. Nobody really wants to do that. I mean, it's nobody ever wins in a religious war. Everybody loses. So there was still some hope that a council could bring unity. In 1530, the Emperor Charles V convened the Estates at Augsburg in order to ascertain whether church unity could be accomplished. So now here, the emperor is following what Luther asked him to do in that treatise in 1520. The Lutherans cooperated fully with what Charles V had asked them to do. It offered their Augsburg Confession and the Apology in a very diplomatic way, and even conceding so many things regarding papal authority. But the rejection of these confessions by the pro-papal party dashed the hope of any unity. And then in June 1536, Pope Paul III called for a council to meet in Mantua. He, too, would like to have some sort of unity. The Lutherans met at Smalcald to determine whether they could compromise and where they could not. Luther wrote the Smalcald articles for that purpose. But the princes opted for reaffirming the Augsburg Confession, and it added a supplement called the Treatise on the Power and Primacy of the Pope. Well, after the Pope saw this, he was not so enthusiastic, and he kept delaying the council, which really did not take place then until Trent, in 1545, and then without any Protestants.
So, ironically, they got what they were hoping for, which was a council, but they were not invited to attend.
Exactly.
So, can you just wrap that piece of history up for us a little bit, how it is that what had spun out of control after 1546, Luther's death, how does the at least for his part, the reform that he wanted to see, how does it eventually come to a form of unity?
Well, there's a back and forth. The emperor tries to recapture the north of Europe for the Catholic forces. He's unable to do that. And so, finally, the Protestants and the emperor agreed upon the religious peace of Augsburg in 1555, which divides the empire religiously, so that the religion of the prince of the territory, or the elector of the territory, is the religion of that territory. So if he's Catholic, then the territory and the people there will be Catholic. If he's Lutheran, they'll be Lutheran. And at that time, only Lutheran and Catholic were acknowledged. Only till after the Thirty Years' War, at 1648 and the Peace of Westphalia, were the German Reformed groups also accepted as a legal form of church. So the Holy Roman Empire, as of 1555, was divided at least into two groups, the Lutherans versus the Catholics, and never the twain would meet again. Now, going back to the turn of our recent century, the Joint Declaration on the Doctrine of Justification intends two things. It intends to eliminate the condemnations that were at the Edict of Worms against Lutherans, and it also tries to bring together a common doctrine of justification. Now, most people recognize that this document has not been successful or influential, but they did try. And the people over in Europe, you have basically state churches over there to get along. You know that they're trying to do that, and so the effects of the Reformation are still being felt in a strong way today, and the churches are still trying to overcome that. But we do have this big problem of not only doctrinal issues that divide us, but the whole approach to theology, whether we are working solely from the scriptures or adding man-made doctrines, that will keep us divided until one or the other gives up.
I have one other question for you that's kind of in this vein. It's a little sub-myth of the myth we've been dealing with, and that is Luther intended to start a new church, or that he intentionally split the church, that and And that sub-myth is that even to this day, then and today, Lutherans essentially follow Luther. That Luther is the not just the figurehead of this Reformation. It's simply whatever Luther says, Lutherans believe and do. How do you respond to that myth?
There's a excellent book by Robert Kolb, our professor emeritus now at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, a book titled Martin Luther as Prophet, Teacher, and Hero, Images of the Reformer, 1520 to 1620. And he takes on this issue of, you know, how have Lutherans looked at Luther? Is he really a hero that we follow at all costs? Do we take every word that he says as the very word of God? Or do we read him somewhat critically? And what he does is he looks at the history, beginning in Luther's life, how his doctrine and his person was received, and then after Luther died and went through the various periods through the interims and then the development of the Book of Concord. And he shows that in Luther's lifetime, he was, at least for Lutherans, he was a great hero. He was a charismatic sort of figure. We don't have anybody close to him on the world stage today. But after his death, and when the church tried to reassemble his doctrine from a variety of treatises, they realized, because of the controversies that they were having, that there were things that he said that contradicted each other. And so this is what forced the church, that is the Lutheran church, to come up with what we call today the Formula of Concord, to settle the disputes that had come about through reading different parts of Luther's theology and different treatises, because he developed his theology. And he says that himself in his 1545 preface. At that time, the development of the Formula of Concord, as Robert Kolb points out, was when they realized that you just can't pull out a quote from Luther and say, thus says the Word of God. That was not their intent. And so instead, they had a body of doctrine that the whole church agreed to after thorough study and said, this is what we are going to teach. It's based on Luther. It comes out of Luther. We wouldn't have had it except for Luther, but the doctrine that we will establish and practice in our church is what's there written in the Book of Concord, not in Luther's works.
So how, just to put a fine point on that, how would you say we ought to regard Luther as Lutherans today? How would you summarize it?
He is a gift. He was a gift in church history to the world. Whether he was prophesied in the Book of Revelation, some people thought that. He had a unique personality. In one sense, he was imbued with the notion of humility from the Augustinian monastery and was always a very humble man. It did not go to his head. On the other hand, he was, as I think Robert Preuss said, he was somewhat irascible. Polemics was one of the ways that he enjoyed getting his word out. And yet, I think Luther himself said that if he had not been so harsh and such a sharp polemical edge, people would not have realized the seriousness of the theological errors of the day. So there's nobody else like him on the world stage before him or after him. He is a unique individual, and even world historians, they place him up there with people like Goethe and, Thomas Aquinas would be maybe the closest in terms of a brilliant theologian. But he's more than just a theologian because he engineered a reform of the church, and at least for the portion that followed him, carried it out in a very effective way that still endures 500 years later. So definitely was a gift of God, and we thank God for them.
Dr. Martin Nolan is former director of the Concordia Historical Institute and pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana. Marty will be back in the next hour to debunk the myth about Lutheranism that Lutherans are liberal. I'm Todd Wilkin. When we come back, we're going to take up that myth. It's one that, you know, Lutherans puzzle at, confessional Lutherans puzzle at, because they don't think of themselves as liberal. Sometimes they find themselves in the position of being politically conservative but theologically liberal. But if you stop and look at least in the 21st century, most of the Lutherans in America, and perhaps even worldwide, at least the Northern Europeans, are very, very liberal. We'll talk about that when we come back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
My name is Michelle, and I'm calling from Los Angeles, California. Issues Etc. brings me home to the truth that Christ is the center of all things. Whether it's news topics or theological topics, Issues Etc. brings Christ and the gospel to me and for me. And I am thankful for Issues Etc. God bless you all.
And we're thankful for listeners like you, Michelle. A lot of, the majority of our listeners are online or on-demand listeners, and we certainly appreciate and are very, very thankful and blessed with the technology that is able to bring Issues Etc. to listeners like yourself. If you'd like to support Issues Etc. with a donation, we certainly could use it, and we need it to stay on the air. Please give us a call, 877-623-6943, 877-623-6943. You can also donate at issuesetc.org. That's a secure online donation. Or you can call us anytime at the office, 618-223-8385. Jeff, I see we've got someone to thank.
Yeah, thanks to our good friend Gail Worley in O'Fallon, Missouri, for your generous contribution to support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. Your best to Roger and the rest of the Worley clan, and thanks so much for listening to Issues Etc. 24 as well. We just got good news. Supper is on the way. Julie and Kurt Johnson. Julie does some part-time accounting work for us, and her husband Kurt, they're on their way from a fundraiser for Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis, and she called, and she's taking orders for supper. So that'll be good to get some supper here as we're quickly approaching the halfway point of Issues Etc. 24.
One more hour. Hey, we had a drawing towards the end of that last interview, and Heather Dewberry from Bremen, Georgia, she's getting the On the Church by Johann Gerhardt, and congratulations to you. And you too can be in the hopper for one of the special books we're giving during Issues Etc. 24 with your gift of $100 or more.
And just to give you an update, what's going on inside the studio? Pastor Wilkin has gone to caffeine. He went to I went to McDonald's. He went to caffeine at approximately the 9:07 mark Central Time. He's going to caffeine a little early this year in Issues Etc. 24. A large coffee from McDonald's. So we'll keep Pastor Wilkin in your prayers, and that he endures and remains steadfast through Issues Etc. 24.
I told him he needs to do some jumping jacks.
Get some,
exercise. Get some blood going, yeah.
I don't know about you, Craig. I think Pastor Wilkin and myself have done laps around the the little office complex throughout the years, and I've brought jump rope,
yeah.
Throughout the years, whatever it takes. A little chilly outside, that helps get your blood pumping as well. But anyway, enough of this inane banter. We really need your support during Issues Etc. 24. Pledge now, 877-623-MY-IE, 877-623-6943. On-demand listeners, 618-223-8385, 618-223-8385, or online, issuesetc.org. For any size donation, we'll send you the book, Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center, by Pastor Daniel Preuss.